Welcome back to BTAC Beyond the Bulletin. We're so happy to have you back for our next podcast today. I'm Dr. Kristen Schneider, and I'm here with my host, Pete Lapp.
Once again, in the same room, I can actually reach over and we can fist bump and do all that kind of stuff. It's always great to be in the same room with you and our guest.
It is indeed. And we've got a really exciting guest to share with our folks today.
We do. We have she's not an archaeologist. I kind of excited when I started looking into her. I was like, I mean, she's an anthropologist.
An anthropologist. Yeah. Working in insider threat.
I know. There's like a lot of questions that we can kind of come up with already. Like, what does, but let's save it for our guest. But Dr. Lisa Briggs is a social scientist and researcher, senior with the U.S. Patent and Trade Office, the USPTO, as we call it, right? And obviously, you know, Dr. Briggs, we want to welcome you to our podcast, but we have a rule here because
we do.
Yeah, Dr. Kristen Schneider,
yep.
You know.
I get to say it once.
She makes me call her doctor once at the beginning, and then I can go to Kristen. It's going to be Lisa from now on, but welcome to our podcast, Lisa. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me here.
Well, we appreciate you coming all the way from where you are, and it's a long trip.
A long journey from PTO.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, I took some time doing some research about you, and we've met through this insider threat work group called ATARC. We meet every 2 weeks. We see each other every 2 weeks on this Zoom, but it's kind of nice to be in person.
ATARC. Acronym?
Oh, gosh.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Advanced. I don't even know. I'd have to Google it.
It's just ATARC.
ATARC. I mean, it just rolls off the tongue. they know who they are.
That's right.
And they were, some of them are very excited that we were getting together because they're big fans of you, not so much me, but you and the topic of online gaming that we're going to talk about. In fact, they were a big proponent of in our work group about, yeah, you guys should do a podcast on online gaming. Okay, we're doing that and we're going to get to that. However, in my vast amount of time that I spent researching you, which would include mostly this morning, because I'm a game day researcher. Like, I get fresh, and then it's like, here, let's.
You don't want old, dated information.
No. And it's kind of good, because on LinkedIn, I saw something that you posted about 4 days ago where you talked about a healthy organizational culture. And what jumped out at me in looking at your background and your biography, you have worked in two very unique insular kind of cultures. The United States Marine Corps, you talked about your Marines, and the USPTO, two very distinct groups of people that I would imagine have their own unique cultures. So from an anthropologist perspective, can you kind of compare and contrast those two cultures that are seemingly diverse in what they do? And
well, let's start with what they have in common and what all of the things that I've been doing, at least as someone in the insider threat space is concerned, is the risk aspect of
yeah.
it. Both have risk. We all know that risk is, you know, .. You can't take that away. How it manifests, though, is where we start getting into the nice, sexy stuff about how are they alike and how are they different and how are they distinct. And I would say that, you know, I'm a little biased and I can admit it. And I think that's the important part in our community, that we know our
bias. Knowing your bias, right?
Yeah.
Well, because we all are, aren't we? We all have biases that we bring to our decision making.
It's normal. I normalize bias and don't say that you can get rid of it because you can't.
Nope.
You can manage it. So by saying it out front, I'm telling you so that you can listen and sort of interpret what I'm saying with that in mind. I spent a lot more time with the Marine Corps. That's part of the bias.
Yeah.
So time in field, time of exposure means that I know a lot more about that. But I mean, you could just go with some real visuals. When you think of a Marine, right, there's a look.
Yeah.
Right. What some of the things you might come up with is the physicality.
Crayons.
And there's the crayons.
Right.
And if there's a poster, they always have the square jaw.
Yeah.
Yep.
No facial hair.
Yep.
They look like they're biting their teeth together. There's like that little.
There's an intensity, isn't there, to the look?
Absolutely. They're usually really well built.
Mm-hmm.
The body standards, physical, the weight, all of those things are definitely a part of the Marine Corps culture. And when you look at the Patent and Trademark Office, it's engineers.
Yeah.
People with really high academic credentials, STEM major folks. They're not in the gym all of the time, like the Marines.
Different focus.
Yeah, they don't shave all the time. They don't have the high and tight haircut. Probably a lot more snacking going on there without any type of, you know, exercise to burn it off. Not a gym culture. And so that means when you look at risk, there's some different considerations. And that's just superficial, jokey stuff. But on a deeper level, the concerns are different. What they do is different.
Yeah.
How they train.
Yeah.
How they do and engage with their jobs is significantly different. Just by putting up some of those physical attributes, you could hear what it might look like on the ground working with groups that come from those types of backgrounds.
Do you find Marines in general, my perception, I was in the Army but and have a great admiration for the Marine Corps. My grandfather was a Marine in World War II. But to me, they come across as like it's an us versus them. Like you're an insider. You've proven yourself by going through Paris Island and wearing that uniform. And if you're not, I know it's a pride, obviously, esprit de corps. But maybe with USPTO, and I'm thinking about this from the anthropology perspective, and the PhDs, the engineers, those types of folks probably have an insider versus outsider mentality, or am I just making this up?
Most of them come from like an academic background.
Yeah.
And when we think about academia in the risk community, we know that we have had in recent times a lot of discussions about the information sharing ethos and how knowledge is built through sharing. And so there's a tendency toward openness that may not be conducive or helpful in a risk reduction situation.
True.
When you talk about national security, patent information, and so it's different.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean,
you've
touched on something that's really important from to social scientists, to any kind of scientist, right? Doing this work, so much of it is about sharing knowledge. And within a government context, that can be very challenging also. Sometimes it's not that we want to share things. It's that we need to protect information.
Absolutely.
So it's that real tension that exists there.
Tension, and also it doesn't match up with how the work is done, right? So the work is not done in academia by hoarding your knowledge.
Right.
You build on. To
right.
get a PhD, you have to extend knowledge beyond what's known. But you have to know what's known to take
first.
That next step.
Mm-hmm.
So you're building. And so you can't not, you know, kind of protect everything and stay in a corner and keep it. You have to build. And so the knowledge building ethos is baked into academic endeavors because knowledge is built. Your theory is an evolution of someone else's theory. So you have to share. Their theory has to be out there. What they did and what their mark was on whatever area has to be known, not protected. Even if you're studying something that has to do with national security. So then to go in and say, well, you can't do that anymore because we have to secure things, so stop, doesn't offer anything that's doable. So part of being an anthropologist is looking at those apparent gaps between cultural groups and trying to figure out how to get us where we need to be so that everyone understands what's going on, what the need is, and how to build in the way that you build or a different way, but that works and suits your cultural environment. Right.
Well, and the Marines do that, right? And in part of the onboarding, the indoctrination into the Marine Corps, I'm sure the drill instructors and the leadership start by talking about Iwo Jima and the different battles that have been fought that the Marine Corps were successful, historical,
mm-hmm.
building on that. You're part of a tradition, a part of a culture. This, you have to know your past in order to be part of. Maybe I'm the first person to say this. There's a lot of similarities between the PhDs and the United States Marine Corps.
That's an interesting idea. I think you might be the first person to say that.
And I've met a ton of very, very intelligent, you know, folks that have worked for the Marines. And it's just like, I'm interested in this dichotomy between the two, but also the similarities that are interesting.
Yeah.
So from an insider threat perspective and an anthropology perspective, in your opinion, what makes a healthy organizational culture? Regardless of where you're at the Marine Corps, the USPTO, the FBI, wherever.
It's an environment where your people are flourishing, where your people are motivated, locked in, they're working toward the mission. There's healthy discourse happening in that organization. If you look at metrics, like metrics as a measure, they're not coming in and leaving out the door as soon as they can. So retention can be a way or a gauge for if you have a healthy culture. The bottom line, though, it's there's no stock definition that applies to everybody because of everyone's culture is different. And I'll give you an example of that. In the Marine Corps, complaining. You would think that complaining is a sign that something's unhealthy.
Right.
Marines complain. And when they're not complaining, it's kind of problematic.
That's where you worry.
Interesting.
Yeah. If Marines aren't complaining, they're not happy. Because it's part of the culture. It's how they process and kind of vent.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're in an insider threat context and you're looking at message trafficking on some sort of system and you see complaints and you're not locked into that cultural idea, you may think that something's wrong with the Marines. They're all complaining and dropping bad words, right?
Yeah.
In their chats and in their this discourse. When that's just them being them.
It's their love language.
Yeah. However, understanding the baseline behavior.
At the Patent and Trademark Office, if they're flaring up in a certain kind of way, if it looked like what the Marines say, I would be really concerned.
Yeah.
Because that's not really STEM academic
discourse.
Yeah. Examiner kind of.
And if you see it, it's a big divergence from their baseline.
Absolutely.
And it lets you know there's something that you need to pay attention to.
Another example, if Marines talk about weapons. And that's a huge indicator. Like people, they talked about weapons, so now let's just go to their houses and check on them and make sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
if it's part of your culture.
Every Marine is a rifleman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so they all have weapons. They talk about it all of the time. They go to the range. They have them in their homes. They collect them. Now, if I started seeing something very similar at the Patent and Trademark Office in some large number, I would be concerned.
Yeah.
Not to say that
context.
There can't be a gun culture or someone who collects guns at the Patent and Trademark Office, but it's not the general way of patent examiners.
Great point.
We wrote a bulletin, I can't remember exactly the topic, but we said disgruntlement is a natural human condition. We all have some degree of disgruntlement, and it's a matter of kind of determining what's Pete's normally on a Monday morning, probably not in a good mood. So that's normal. You know, if all of a sudden he was happy on a Monday, we should probably be concerned. And then if he carried that through for the rest of the week, it's like a gold star. Disgruntlement's a normal human condition that I think we all have to, as insider threat professionals, appreciate, respect, and be able to put it into context depending on the scenario that you're in, I think. And not be overly concerned all the time, but be aware enough to be thinking, hey, this is starting to get, he or she is really harping on this a lot. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's something that could be a concerning behavior.
Yes.
So organizational culture, really a lot, there's no recipe. We can't just apply one algorithm and make it perfect. It's context driven. It's each organization has its own unique culture. You transitioning from the Marine Corps to the USPTO, I'm sure it was a challenge, right? Because I don't know if you swear or not, curse or not, but it probably got better if you went, you had to like be careful, a little more careful. Like you couldn't be as creative with your swear words like you could at the Marine Corps if you so chose, right?
Yeah, it's certainly been a shift because not only working with the Marines, but having worked with the Department of War since 2004.
Yeah.
I grew up in Department of War cultures, different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different environment from civilian only or private sector type of places. So the humor, what's allowable, what people say, is really different.
And very much so.
I often find myself at USPTO kind of just watching, paying attention and absorbing the dynamics and what's talked about and what's seen as important, what's privileged, what's given front and center, what people laugh about. And a few times I've had awkward moments where I've said something and it was just crickets.
Yeah. The humor itself can be really different.
And on Teams, I've made comments and then nothing, and I just erased it.
Well, it still happened. Even though you erased it, it's still there.
So let's retract that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in writing, too, it's especially hard because humor is sometimes very hard to read without the facial expression, the tone of voice.
Yeah. Yep. So even though understanding cultures is kind of my thing, my jam, I have to bump along as well, just like anyone else, being in a different type of culture, especially after having that long period of time. With the Department of War and different entities under that fabric.
Well, I mean, even at some point, the Marine Corps was new to you, and you had to get used to that entire dynamic, right? I'm sure it became very familiar over time, but at the first, it was an entirely new experience and new culture to absorb.
It always is, and one of the things about being an anthropologist is that you're trained to do that.
Yes.
But there's training and then there's doing.
Yeah.
Not any good soldier would know that. Anybody who's aware of that sort of the uptick that it takes to get integrated into something. And so as I knew what was going to happen and saw it, I also had to do it.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious. Lots of very funny moments, not just with the Marine Corps, but lots of different members of the services, because I was in a combatant command at the time when I was supporting the Marine Corps at first. And there were a lot of different types, and trying to figure it out when I'm not one of them is always an interesting thing. And there's a term in anthropology called gaining entree.
Huh.
And it's one of the steps, right, that you do. And there's certain things you do to gain entree. And even though I wasn't sitting around saying, okay, today I'm going to do step 1 through 3 at this meeting and that meeting, it's much more what we all do, but we just sort of set it up and you learn it. There are lots of times when I would go into the room, and lots of it involves watching and paying attention, which I think if you don't have that as an inherent characteristic or something that you like to do, it's probably not the area of study for you, because you're always watching and trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Very intentionally. So I was in rooms doing that a lot, and in making mistakes, and in engaging, and in sitting back and being taught things. So a lot of the iterations of that type of thing to learn, and then asking questions to get more information so that I can better integrate and come back and do better. Gaining people's trust.
Yeah.
Showing your value and your worth, especially with the Marines, because they are a very, as you mentioned before, insular group, and they're not very trusting. And also understanding the context, because I was with them when they were doing field-based operations in theater during the same time that we had Afghanistan going on.
Mm-hmm.
So these are people who are having these engagements, coming to things, and then there's me. So if you understand culturally, I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
They're coming from the front, and they're, who's this person, and why is she here, and what is she doing? Is she a narc? Like, why did they send her? And all of those things.
Yeah. And is she here? Is she evaluating us? What's happening?
Negotiating that and trying to figure out how to make it all come together is part of not just the technique of it, but, you know, there's an art and as well as a science to how you develop that over time.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think, I want to go back even farther, right? What were you doing there? What brought you to this world? As an anthropologist, did you know that this was going to be your direction? Did you know you wanted to get involved in insider threat, for example? What was it that initially got you moving in that direction?
You know, I wish I could say when I was a child, I would sit around saying, I'm going to go and talk about culture. Some people know.
Sure.
They're doing news reporting or they're playing doctor. What I knew as a child was that I was innately curious.
Yeah.
And I was always a watcher and an introvert.
Yeah.
Not that you have to be one to be an anthropologist. But I was really comfortable sitting and watching how things played out. And I would sit around and watch my mother, sort of hang out with her friends, having tea and smoking cigarettes, which is what they did in the 70s when I was a kid. Yes, I'm that old. and I'd listen to what they said and try to understand what they were talking about. And I'm like 6, so I don't have a lot of context, right? So, but I'm watching them talk and in my mind mapping out the dynamics. Well, she talks a lot. She just laughed and she said, and I've always been that. And that's who I am.
Yeah.
It's not something I can turn on or off. It took years to figure out how to make that turn into a paycheck and a career and something that was really, I didn't know.
Well, it's interesting because you brought that up, because your undergraduate degree is in psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it a big leap to go into anthropology? I mean, I feel like most people that are interested in psychology and understanding some of the dynamics that you have, is this person introvert, extrovert, all that kind of thing that you were observing. What's the leap between psychology and anthropology?
Well, they're all part of the behavioral science.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's different is the context.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologists are looking at behaviors in a much more specific area. They're looking at what's happening with a person, and anthropologists are broader. We're looking at the context for those behaviors.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's happening? What's going on here? And the behaviors are an interplay. And are connected, really well connected to the context. Like we just talked about example after example. Yes, they're talking about weapons and they're really excited about it. Those are some behavioral tendencies and characteristics, but what's the context for which that's occurring? It's occurring in the context of a group of people who are trained with rifles, who are war fighters. That's the context.
Right.
And that's the culture.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's how they go together. They're all looking at behaviors, but just a different lens of analysis. And they're all grounded in science. So I don't just get to walk around and say things about what Marines are like. You have to have data and evidence to support it. So you need data. You need to do and conduct and collect information in ways that are systematic and that are verifiable and that can be repeated. There's still a science behind it, which is really hard.
Yeah.
So for people to kind of to know with anthropology or any of the other sciences, and people think that they know, and I talk about this a lot because I hear culture, the word used over and over again.
Yeah.
And I think what culture means to other people and what it means to me are a little different because I study it. It's a science. It's not just a word. And I'm not negating what people think about culture. And
no.
I don't think that people don't know their cultures.
Right.
And when they say, in our culture, we are this way, I'm not saying that they're not, that it's not true, but can they prove it?
Yeah.
With data.
Yeah.
So I'm going
to
open.
Usually don't have to.
Yeah. I'm going to open a door, and I'm a little worried about this because Kristen is a huge fan of research.
I am.
Huge.
I am.
Fan.
Where are we going with this, Pete?
Well, let me as an anthropologist, what's the most interesting research that you've ever done?
Ooh. Good question.
Or research in general, but more sorts. I'm kind of interested in this anthropology track of your background. What's the most interesting research that you've been that maybe you've been most surprised about because you had a hypothesis going in and then you did the research and you're like, oh, I was completely wrong.
Usually with anthropology, it's good, at least my approach, is to not have a strong hypothesis because of bias.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It'll keep you from seeing what is, and you'll see what you want to see, and everything else start falling in, you know, editorially cuts and lay on the ground, and you'll only see it. Sort of like if all you have is a hammer, you know, that adage.
Yeah.
Yep.
All you see are nails. So want to stay as loose as possible. Maybe have some questions that you're trying to kind of answer, and then just go in and get it all. It's messy. I think quantitative analysis is cleaner because you just put a survey out with specific things you want to know and then you match that to the answers. But with anthropology, you're trying to build it from the ground up with nothing. You might have done some reading to give you general framework, but you have to see it as it evolves. It kind of comes out of the ground. I didn't read a book to understand Marine Corps culture.
You were in it.
I had to
You were exposed
it.
And live it, yeah.
Collected over and the data points came in the stories, repetitive stories that sort of saturated categories of understanding that I was building. And then I could read something that would tell me something, or they could say Marines like weapons. Great, that's a nice piece of information, but I didn't really know that until all I saw them talk about over and over again was weapons. I saw and experienced them with, like on the range, shooting in competitions with other members of different armed forces, and the Marine always won.
Yep.
And, you know, I got it. I was like, oh, they might like weapons.
Well,
so you don't know, but that saturates that point. And then if you looked at statistics on how many are trained and what their levels are, and historically, those are the data points that can help solidify that category of understanding about Marines.
Got it.
And as a behavioral scientist, those experiences become your data points,
yes.
Don't they?
Yeah, and they're transformative, which is another thing that I find fascinating about being an anthropologist. And I would say in the behavioral scientists, all of the categories, that's that transformative notion because you live with the data, and which is why it becomes really compelling and difficult to walk away from. You asked earlier, though, the question about what's been really powerful. And I would say I can't put one over the other. I would say the one that's been very kind of hard to move away from has been the Department of War and what it's about in that cultural part. Mm-hmm. It has been transformative in many ways for me personally, outside of my mindset as a researcher, and that it's helped me see my country differently.
Interesting.
Yeah. Right? I'm more wedded to what we are because I see and hear so much about it. So if that's not something that you want to do, or that might not happen to everybody, but that's what it's done in terms of some of the transformations that I feel. I have a different feeling about rituals surrounding military culture than I did before. I can't imagine not putting my hand on my right. heart and, you know, facing the flag and feeling some sort of way based on my experiences, and not right. because everyone does it, but because of how I understand that to mean and the power and weight of it from my experiences. See? And so that's the effect of that science of yeah. doing the work, right? So,
but I think some of our listeners might actually be surprised by that, yeah. right? I mean, on a human level, I think it makes sense to all of us.
Yes.
But I think we have this idea of the scientist as the detached observer mm-hmm. who isn't going to feel anything,
no.
right? And that's not actually very realistic, is it?
No. If you're doing it right, and that's my air quotes with that, and this is my opinion, not science. You can't separate it completely because I'm human.
Right.
Were I a machine, again, I think sometimes surveys and people who do quant have it easier because you just, and even them, I think they get transformed by the results.
Yes.
But you're not touching the data.
Yeah.
The hours and hours that I've spent in the field with all kinds of people, I can hear their interviews in my head like tracks. I remember talking with people in Liberia and working on Ebola and being in Kenya, listening to members of the Kenyan Armed Forces and the women in the military, which is a study I did, and what they said about their experience with being women in the
yeah.
military. That's what's important. So there's no one. It's
yeah.
sort of a cumulative effect of these repeated exposures
mm-hmm.
to people sharing data points, which is what they are, but they're really their stories,
yeah.
right?
It's interesting because I came from an FBI culture, and there are certain organizations and cultures that the individuals that are a part of that, it becomes their identity to a degree, and maybe in times a little bit unhealthy, because it's like, well, what happens when you're no longer wearing the uniform, carrying the badge, carrying the gun? That's kind of a side thing that I have, but like, going back to the Marines, I mean, they see themselves as Americans and patriotic, but they see themselves as Marines first. Like, that's kind of like, from the identity perspective, it's like, nope.
It's actually an important part of it,
it's
isn't it?
It's a part of who they are as a person. And I know a lot of my former colleagues kind of saw themselves as FBI agents first. And then they were like sons, daughters, parents, all that other kind of other things, the other titles or identities that we take on. But it's not universal. I don't know that, you know, folks at the patent and trade office are going, I'm a patent and trade, you know, I'm a PTO person. It's like, yeah, that's where I work, and I'm committed to the mission and the job, but I'm...
You're good.
I'm not getting a tattoo on the inside of my lip that says USPTO.
Probably not.
Probably not.
I think that one of the reasons why the Marine Corps has been compelling, and I have to put it in perspective, I've been to and studied and worked in almost half the countries on the continent of Africa.
Wow.
I've looked at many, many cultures,
mm-hmm.
many micro cultures, different languages, people who eat really different things,
mm-hmm.
live in really different housing situations, has very different economic, but the Marines brings me back every time.
Yeah.
I can't get bored. There's so much there. It is one of the greatest examples of branding through its enculturation mm-hmm. and indoctrination process that I've ever seen, and the lack of disconnect between what they want to produce and what they produce is to say, but they do a really good job of kind of catching the tropes because they're so strong.
Heartbreak yeah. Ridge,
they're
Few
so
Good
strong.
Men.
Just
oh my
the
gosh.
The voice, the mannerisms, the bearing. You can ask most strangers what they think of the Marine Corps and get a lot of similarity in responses because
yep.
the brand is the brand.
Well known.
It's the brand.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just so known, it's strong.
Yeah.
Right.
Everyone knows what it
recognizable
the characteristics
yep.
because it's been embedded so strongly in the hearts and minds of those who've experienced it and well publicized. It's a great feat in I don't know, what do you call that? Marketing?
Yeah. Basically, right?
And I think that's what really fascinates me
yeah.
about the Marine Corps. Who did this? Like, is this repeatable? Like, where else can you take things from this and use it other other places. And there is diversity. I don't want people to think that the Marine Corps is a monolithic organization. There's so much diversity within, but they have a brand. They have a thing. When you look at their marketing posters, and I've looked at their campaigns and their thing, people remember, you know, the few, the proud, you yep. know. Yeah, all of these types of slogans have become part of American culture.
And true. More.
And they've even kind of eclipsed the Marine to become part of military identity and cultures.
Yep. I got to do one movie thing. You're prompting me. Like, I have two books by my bedside. The King James Bible and the United States Marine Corps Code of Conduct. It's Few Good Men. It's the classic movie.
Such a good film.
And the way it actually, I feel, it's a kind of movie that really epitomizes the Marine Corps, the culture, mm-hmm. a lot of aspects of it that in a brilliant, brilliant way. I'm going to watch it again this weekend just because it's... I gotta
be it's able been to a while.
Pull, I got to quote again. I mean, pull it in, but... So to transition to online gaming, another culture
yeah.
that is unique. And I will say, like, you know, from I don't know, Kristen, if you're a gamer or not. I'm going to say no.
I wouldn't claim the identity. I do a little bit of gaming. I'm known to fall down the hole into Hogwarts Legacy for a little while, and I can spend quite a few hours
oh, good.
Flying around on a broomstick
okay.
getting into adventures. But that's pretty much the limit of my gaming.
Yeah, the gaming for me, I'm 56 years old, and when I grew up, so we didn't grow up with a whole lot of extra income to buy gaming systems. And, you know, Atari was the big one.
Oh, yeah.
When I was, you know, a young kid. And my friends had Ataris, but I didn't have one of my own. So I don't think the gaming thing never caught on to me. Now, I will say it's caught on with my son. I would consider him a gamer. We wrote a bulletin, BTAC wrote a bulletin back in September 2025, and we'll put it in the show notes here.
Yes.
When we do publish this. 201 million Americans, including servicemen and veterans, and engage in video games. And I just think
that's a lot.
Two-thirds of the U.S. gamers spend 6 to 10 hours weekly gaming. That's a phenomenal amount of time. And we're not just talking, well, I don't think Atari's in business anymore. We're not talking just Xboxes, but we're also talking Candy Crush, right? The little apps on your phone, I think that would consider a gamer, right?
I think that's probably true. I think a lot of people now are engaging on their phone, which is probably why we have so many people, right? We've all for the most part got a phone somewhere near us, right? And so gaming on the phone, gaming on video game consoles, and then gaming on the computer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and now unlike when we were growing up, because I think we're kind of close to the same age, there's a social aspect to it because everyone's interconnected. So let's talk about the risk from an insider threat perspective. There's probably a lot of positives. I think anytime we can be part of a community of people and interacting with people, even if it's not in person, I do think that from a psychological perspective, and I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV once in a while. you know, I think that can be a healthy thing, but let's talk about the unhealthy aspects from an insider threat perspective on online gaming. From your perspective, Lisa, how do you look at it from an insider threat perspective?
And what does it have to do with insider threat?
Well, it doesn't have to do anything with it. It's risk is just what it is. It's risk. It's not a promise. It's not a guarantee. It's just risk.
Yeah.
Right? You know? And risk is everywhere, and it can be a part of all sorts of spaces. When it comes to gaming, the thing about gaming, and I have to talk about culture.
Yeah, please.
You know, is that it's a culture that plays into some of the ways that folks engage, you know. Online spaces are third spaces,
yeah.
which is a sociological term for what we used to call places like parks and bars, where people go to socialize, let off steam, you know, and online is now that place. It is that. And so it's its own culture. It's an emerging culture that has different rules, different terrain. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that there is a disconnect between that sort of place as a third space and other places in the past that were more visible.
Yeah.
And part of that has to do with what you said. When I was younger, I didn't pick up games. is that it has a generational component.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
And although all people are online, not all people are on games in the same ways. And there is a disconnect, which means that younger people, like the child you referenced, who's a gamer, are there and you're not.
Yeah.
So they're developing an entire way of interacting that's not so visible to folks who aren't a part of it.
Right.
So there's a disconnect.
Yeah.
That can create misunderstanding, but it also creates risk because now we have a whole thing where some of us don't know what others of us are doing, and lots of stuff is going on. And the way that you interface with online tools is different from how you interact in face-to-face.
Very true.
Kind of scenarios. I heard it said more than once today, I'm so glad we get to see each other.
Yeah.
And that's contextual.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's also a cultural thing now.
Yeah.
Which seems like it's just, well, of course everyone wants to see each other.
No, they don't. They don't necessarily, right? Especially some of the younger people.
Absolutely. Because they are making new ways of connecting and finding meaning and making connections. And that is culture.
Yeah.
And it's behavioral.
Yeah.
And so the risk part comes is in that we need to come up with different ways of contextualizing engagements and interactions to deal with the realities of who's online. There are a lot of types online.
Yeah.
When we look at, the tetrad and the types of behavioral concerns that we have, those people are online too.
Mm-hmm. They are. Yeah. You're right. We think of these things when we're talking about platforms or spaces, we tend to start with this assumption that we're dealing with the average person entering those places. And we often are, but we're also talking about people who might be experiencing really intense challenges, have, really troubling personality characteristics. Mm-hmm. All of these people are in all of these spaces. Yes.
From the risk perspective, most of the types of concerns we have, narcissists, people with different types of personality issues that can exacerbate risk, they're drawn to games. Not just online,
yeah.
Games in particular, because some
excellent
of the rewards
point.
That support their sense of themselves or whatever they're managing, they can stoke them there. So if you have ideas of grandiosity and you want to be cruel to people, online is a great space where you can act that out.
Yes.
You can beat people down mercilessly in a game.
Yeah.
You can be the top scorer. You can rage and say things online.
In a way that's actually socially acceptable in a lot of cases, or encouraged even, right?
Yeah. And so it's rampant for risks of the types of people that we're concerned about with none of the sort of fail-safes and protections and the monitoring that we have. And so people who are just having fun there and are not aware, aren't like watching as they engage, are at risk.
Yeah.
And those types of behaviors can exacerbate and sort of help create and push people along the trajectory of things, make them feel bad about themselves, make them angry.
Yep.
And I'm saying make them as though they don't have agency, and they do. Mm-hmm. But without the awareness, there's triggers.
They're reacting.
They're reacting and responding to things in an environment that they believe is their safe space, their third space. That's where they're going to let their hair down. And that part about letting your hair down, behavioral disinhibition, is a phenomenon that's really on the rise and connected to online and gaming centers.
Well, it gets amplified online, that kind of disinhibition, doesn't it?
It does. It's allowed. And also the reduction in the type of social cues you get from person face to face. Like you're watching me use my hands, you're looking at my gestures, I'm watching you. We see these things, and in the online world, those aren't there anymore.
Yep.
And while they may be meaningful to us, because we are people who like the face-to-face thing, for folks who don't, they don't read those the same way.
Yeah.
They're different, using different maps and cues for understanding the world that they're in.
And language.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything. There's completely different languages that they're speaking. And do you speak the language?
My son would say no.
Probably not.
No, Dad.
Probably none of us do, right?
And you hear this all the time outside of gaming sites when people, even when people date online.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of people who think that that's just the worst thing in the world.
Yep.
And it's become normalized.
Very much so.
There are generations of people who have married and have families based on swiping right.
Yeah.
Right? You see? So it's a disconnect. And it's not good or bad. That's the thing
right.
that I always tell, especially... it's important in our places of policy and influence, because the people who are making decisions tend to be older.
Yeah.
And not a part of that. And so they don't get it.
And it's foreign to them.
And there's a tendency to reject.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. The first time I ever heard of Discord was because of Airman Jack Teixeira,
yeah.
And it was like, what is this Discord thing? And it opened my I spent my career as a counterintelligence espionage professional, and this was not a vehicle to committing espionage or an unauthorized disclosure in a way that I ever thought of. It caused me to kind of open up the computer and start looking at what is Discord and what does it mean, and what kind of relationship can it create with people that, like you said, there are positives and then there are some risks and negatives to that. And how should we be looking at that?
And how do we protect? And the answer isn't stop it. You can't. You're not going back. We're all on screens, and people are gaming, and
the internet is not going away.
And so, in the context of the work where I created that, I was still with the Marine Corps, and I remember going out to Okinawa, and we were going around talking about risk and insider threat. And I started a survey, and I asked them if they were online, if they were gaming, and we talked about the games. And then I asked them a couple of questions about their gaming behaviors.
Yeah.
Because as third spaces tend to be, you're relaxed, you're talking. And then I mentioned to them, are you aware of who you're always talking to when you're sharing these things about what you did in training, the type of equipment that you're working on here in the Marine Corps, and, you know, even what you got on? I said, and those types of things can become national security issues. And not because it's classified, but because the compilation, it can get a better sense of what you're doing. And the blank stares that I got back and the open mouths, because they didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's just an example of potential for types of risks that we can have when we're not talking about this, when we're not acknowledging it. And again, that disconnect from those who are now in a position to make a difference and to respond. Policy people who tend to be older generationally and aren't on the games. They're not even tuned in. Or the second piece, have a very negative response or dismissive. Oh, these kids, they're just woe is me, doom gloom. Oh, these, they're not going to be worth, you know, that kind of isn't going to help us turn the tide on the risk at all. It's not helpful.
No, that's exactly right.
So, like the other cultures that you've immersed yourself in, have you immersed yourself in the online gaming culture at all? Do you game? Are you a gamer?
I'm not a gamer.
Okay.
I can't even use the little controller because that becomes a part of your hardwiring too. If you don't start, you know, you can't figure out how to make a move and jump and do the things. And I don't have the hand eye or the coordination to do it.
Yeah. I read a really interesting article this morning, actually, that was saying that on some of the subs, they are using Xbox 360 controllers. Mm-hmm. And they're actually using them for the machinery because everybody knows how to use them.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And they're easy to get. They're easy to replace. And the kids already know how to use them. They're very adept with them because they've grown up with them.
Yeah.
I could be wrong with Space Force. You know, when it was created back in 2018, drew a lot of folks that were from the online gaming community culture that have that as an aspect of their personalities, and they naturally gravitate, because you're not going to fly in space, mm-hmm. but you're going to maybe control things that fly in space.
Right.
That's probably what you're doing at Space Force. And it's certainly, and I don't know that it's predominantly probably in the younger cultures, whatever age groups, whatever generations we want to put that in. But I mean, I think there are some dads and maybe some moms out there that are of our ages and that are also considered gamers because kind of grew up. And I don't at all, any stretch, I am not trying to degrade the online gaming culture because I'm not in it. I just frankly don't get it. I would rather spend my time being outside, walking, hiking, golfing, mm-hmm. gardening, perhaps, maybe. That's just me. It's just kind of like more how I was raised and how I prefer to spend my free time, if you will.
Yeah. Well, but I think there are some real advantages to it too. I mean, think about during COVID, right? You had everybody kind of stuck at home for a while. If you're, you know, of any age, but if you want to connect with your friends, if you want to engage, you know, a lot of us, our work might have moved online, you know, we're at home, but where do we have access to those third spaces, right? It's going to be online. And so you want to connect with your friends, you want to do something fun. It's the opportunity to connect, to have a sense of community, to have shared interests, and something that you're doing that kind of gets you out of your house, even though you can't get out of your house, right? So I think there's some real significant advantages. But you actually identified, I think, one of the biggest challenges and potential areas of risk, which is that we don't always know who we're talking to. And it's much harder to pretend to be someone else in real life than it is online. It's very easy to create a fake persona online, and not everyone is even looking out for that or aware that they have to be careful of who they're talking with, right?
Yes. So that type of hygiene and sort of the cultural way of, you know, when you're dealing with traditional third spaces, you learn things like when you go in the bar, you have a wing person who helps you make sure if you go into the bathroom, someone watches you drink. If you end up sick, they hold your hair. Like, we have rituals built into how we protect one another in those spaces. And those same types of protections for the types of risks that can happen related to insider threat, they just aren't there.
Yeah.
And two, the cues are different. So even trying to develop cues for a group of people who are not engaging in the same ways, how do we know what to tell them?
Right. What should you be looking for?
If you're not there, what do you tell them? I can speak in generalities.
Yeah.
And we're learning and we're getting better about people talking to you, the types of things. Some things are just the things. You know, if someone's eliciting you,
right,
that doesn't change online. They still do the same things. They start asking you about stuff that, and getting deeply interested in your, you know, that part.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it might look a little bit different, right?
Yeah, but the words will be the words. Yep. Hey, what do you do? How much do you make for that job?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing that? Really? Do you get to see any good classified information?
Yep.
On game sites, even if they're texting it, it's the same game.
Yeah.
You can read it and see that someone's being, you know, groomed or other things for and grooming for other purposes as well.
Great point.
The also. The game is still the game, but are we talking about that? Because you're playing a game thinking you're just doing the equivalent of having a drink and hanging out with your friends, and you're not watching for it.
That's exactly right.
You're not marking and spotting and checking while you're playing games, because you're dropping your guard because it's your space. It's
where you go. It feels like a safe space.
Right.
Yeah.
And oftentimes in these groups, people are with people they do know and then with strangers.
Yes, both.
Like in a bar. Yeah, you might go with your group, but there are strangers around.
Well, I also find this in particular with some of my teenage patients that I work with, that I've learned over time, I have to ask them, you know, I'll have a teenage client tell me about her new boyfriend and, you know, is very, very focused on the relationship and interested in, you know, spends hours a day talking to him. I've learned I have to ask, is this ever somebody that you've met in person? It occurs to me the first time that I ask, what does this person look like? Oh, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? How is this your boyfriend if you don't know what they look like? And then realizing that for a lot of, particularly this younger generation, they're not making the same distinctions between, you know, online relationships and in real life relationships that you or I would make.
Right.
That they've become so used to having these relationships online. And then particularly during COVID lockdown, and I lived in California, so it lasted a really long time. People were really locked down for a while, where this was their only opportunity to make these kinds of friendships and relationships. And to recognize that these kids are not necessarily making that distinction or understanding that this person may not be who they claim to be. And as hard as that is for an adult to judge, it's even more challenging for an adolescent.
Yes. The thing is, when I looked into the science behind connections, what we tend to think is that they're not real connections. Cognitively, they are.
They are very real.
So when someone tells you their best friend is somebody they've been playing games with for a year and they've never met them,
yep,
it's the same as, I call it the my bestie who lived around the corner, she's right there.
Right.
I used to go to her home. I know her parents. I know what her dog was like. I've seen every aspect of her life. But from a cognitive perspective, when they do the science, my beliefs and their beliefs are the same.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, and they've never met.
So when you think that you can dismiss their feelings about it,
you can't.
You're doing them a disservice.
Oh, no.
Because in the brain, that relationship is just like my best friend Monique.
It is, unless the person is not who they say that they are.
Well, of course.
Right. So, and that's the real challenge, uh-huh. right? Because you're right. It is a real relationship.
It is real on paper and yep. In the labs.
Yep.
It's wow. not just, but we think it can't be because of how we
think. How we think, yeah, yep. our bias.
But yep. for their brain and their cognitive processing, it's the same.
Yeah.
It's just as real, you know. And when they use the friend word, because I used to, you know, oh, your friend? Yeah. My friend and when we were friends, my friends, we did X, Y, and Z chain of things from yep. my generation. But their friends are their friends.
Yeah.
Even when they're over there in some other place.
Well,
and that's real. And it's been tested and shown to be the case for how they connect.
Right. Well, I think for our generation, it's a little easier to think about perhaps the people you haven't seen in a really long time, mm-hmm. right? The folks that you stay in touch with that are your friends that maybe you stay in touch with online, over the phone. Maybe those relationships started off in person, but if they've been remote for a long time, that person is no less your friend, right? Than a person that you see in real life, right?
Yeah. So it sounds to me like you would be a proponent of insider threat training, bringing in conversations and maybe some best practices about the different positive aspects of gaming and platforms and interaction with people, and just to be making them cognizant of who they're talking to from a potential insider threat perspective. Not scaring them, not making them paranoid, but just that awareness. I think it sounds like you would be an advocate for
all
that.
All about the awareness. I think that's the first yeah. step. We haven't gotten far enough to be able to do more. And so we should at least do that.
Yeah.
Minimally. Treat them how to have defensive awareness and to, while they're in their third space, to cover their drink, have their
yeah.
wash
yeah.
when they go to the bathroom.
How do you cover your drink online?
That's a good question.
It's a metaphor
yeah.
for the
yeah, yeah.
types of things that we would do in our third spaces. They need to do in theirs, and that needs to be a part of their training. And that's a very, a much better sort of framework of reference and a way of addressing it than what we're doing now, which is a lot of, can you believe they're doing that? It's
right.
not real.
That's not too helpful, is it?
You know, I've seen a pattern with our podcast. Every time we do an interview, I have homework.
Yeah, you do seem to get a lot
second
of homework.
Second day in a row, I have homework.
Self-assigned.
Self-assigned. It's not like Brandon said, hey, you need to research this, or you, Dr. Schneider. But I got to go learn more about gaming and the positive aspects and all that. So we've taken a lot of your time, and we want to wrap up by, we always finish our conversations with discussions about self-care. And what do you, as a person, do for self-care? Now, we've known each other for a while. I know one of your go-tos is gardening. How is your current garden, and how do you think it's going to be this summer?
Good question.
It's going well. We just got through the first flush of blooms on the roses.
Oh,
nice.
The next sort of iteration of roses and blooms is when the beetles come out and they eat all of the roses.
So your gardens are flowers?
Flowers, some herbal things. But, you know, I'm by myself, so I don't grow a lot of food because I don't want to waste it.
Got it.
So I grow things that I'll use. So there's rosemary, there's thyme, there's strawberries,
yep.
which actually the squirrels eat.
So
yep.
you do have strawberries.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a big fan of strawberries, as Kristen well knows. We need to hook up later, and once your strawberries are, because is it now or they're
starting? But let me just tell you, you would compete with the squirrels. They
you got to get there early.
Oh.
The squirrels eat them, and in a way, we kind of have this like wink and
you can have those
relationship.
Leave yep. these alone. You can have those.
When I see them there, and I'm like, it's so you're good.
Nice.
I have wild strawberries that grow in my yard, and I never get any of them.
No. So don't
the squirrels. The squirrels eat them.
They eat them.
The rabbits.
The rabbits do.
They love them.
So I share most of my garden with wildlife.
Oh, that's not nice of you. Yeah.
It's a wildlife garden.
Yeah, you know. And
that sounds wonderful, though.
That's what I do. I think that I think part of the thing of recognizing what your role is and how it impacts you as a behavioral scientist, someone who worked in enforcement, any of those communities comes with a tax for the work that you do, especially if you do it with passion.
Yeah.
And you can get overwhelmed pretty quickly. And in the case of the kind of thing of trying to understand what's going on, it started as a kid. It never had a pause or a stop. It never ends. Even if I'm not at work, I'm wondering what's going on.
Yeah.
I would liken it to people who have a heightened sense of awareness.
Yeah.
It's kind of a character. So I have to find things that help me.
Because you can't turn it off. No. That intellectual curiosity does not.
You know, I'm a regular at IHOP, and I know all the colors, what's going on. I know the backgrounds of the people there. I've looked at the culture, and I do that while eating breakfast.
Yeah. Breakfast. Everywhere you go, I'm sure.
It never stops. I do it simultaneously while talking here. I'm doing it here.
Yeah.
So I have to find things that get me out of that.
And I imagine alone time is part of that.
A lot of alone time.
Yeah.
To the point where my neighbor thinks I don't like people.
Oh, that's not true.
I love them so much.
Yeah.
Study
them.
You also need to be away from them sometimes.
The yard and grounding myself in the soil is that place for me. It's where I don't think about.
That's where you can turn it off.
I don't do culture in the yard.
Interesting.
In the dirt, you know, and so I just get
You can just be present.
And I get the shovel, and I just dig trenches and make patterns and put strawberries and lift bags of mulch and spread them.
Strawberries for the squirrels.
Sweat and I don't
Sounds pretty great.
I don't think about things. The problem is when the off season, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you did just say something that kind of struck me, though. I'm in this room and I'm studying, and I'm like, oh boy, here we go.
It's a problem.
Yeah, no, but I'm feeling a little seen and self-aware.
You know that once you say that and put it out there in the room, everyone's like,
oh, everyone's just like,
watching
what's all the time we have for today?
I get that all the time from people when I first meet them. They automatically assume I'm analyzing them, and I promise I'm not. Yeah. I've got other things going on, too.
Just every other interaction we have. She analyzes.
I tell him I'm not diagnosing him, at least.
At first, you probably did, though, didn't you?
Yes, there's always a little bit of a diagnosis going on in the background.
I got a bachelor's degree because of that very thing.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I could see how that could become a. Like the mole on the, what's that movie with the mole?
Oh, Seinfeld. Mole!
You can't stop seeing it.
Yeah, and so I can't stop wondering what's going on. Like, what are they doing? Where is it? I wonder how that is, and while simultaneously engaging in life. So, it's a occupational hazard, I think.
Or a gift. A gift.
Yeah,
could be a
little
gift.
Bit of both, maybe.
Yeah, too much is waste. So you got to.
Dr. Briggs, thank you so much for joining us, Lisa. I will see you tomorrow on our, on our every other week call, and I'm so excited to share little bits about our conversation tomorrow. And your partnership and your friendship is means a lot to us. And thank you for taking the time to talk about anthropologists.
I think we learned a lot today. Hopefully, our audience did as well.
I'm sure they did. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your service to the Marine Corps. Just for the record, I did not make one Marine Corps joke. Not one.
I think you might have mentioned something about crayons. That just slipped in.
I would never make a joke like that. So. Roll the tape back. Lisa, thanks a lot for taking the time and being a great guest for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Briggs.
Thank you.
And thanks all of you for joining us today. Come back for another podcast with BTAC Beyond the Bulletin.
Once a month we put them out, so stick around for next month. See. If you sign up for the show, it automatically goes to you when we drop an episode. So, and by all means, please, either on LinkedIn or wherever you get your podcast, please leave a review.
Yeah, let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear next.
We encourage positive reviews if you don't
particularly
mind. Yes, but we appreciate your feedback as always. Thanks a lot, everybody. Stay safe.
Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
The views and opinions presented herein are those of the interviewer and or interviewee and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of War or its components, including Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, or DCSA. Further, any reference to the use of specific resources or consultation with non-government personnel does not constitute endorsement by the Department of War, its components, or DCSA.